Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply. Before we dive into today's episode, we have a special mini interview with John Purcell, CPO of Doit, sharing invaluable insights for CTOs. On the line, I have John Purcell, and John is the CPO of Doit, who do support this podcast as a sponsor. I have to admit that I'm a big fan personally because I use their service and it's awesome. So, John, what do you do at Doit?
Yeah, thanks, Toby. It's great to be with you. So Doit is a company that works with digital native organizations to get their arms around their cloud operation and ensure that they're doing that effectively, economically, and securely as they're approaching scale moments or as their business is scaling in the cloud. And we provide that support with a combination of smart technology, some of the world's best consultancy expertise, and a support model that is highly disruptive in the market. And it's a combination of those integrated value components that over 4,000 customers have chosen to work with us. And we see more and more customers coming on board every day, which we are just humbled and honored to keep going in the market.
And I think many companies come in through the cost angle. Is that correct?
They do. Cost analysis and cost control in the cloud, I think still to this day, what are we, almost 20 years since the cloud first sort of was launched with S3 from Amazon. The cost of the cloud, I think, remains one of the most important questions that companies deal with, especially scaling companies, and we deal with that every day.
What is your advice for CTOs of SaaS companies in the current startup climate that have to shift gears towards profitability?
I think there are probably three pieces of advice, Toby, that I would share. The first is to make sure that you are generating the right kind of and the most accurate kind of analysis that tells you not just what your monthly bill is in the cloud, but why that is your monthly bill. Where are those costs coming from? The beauty of the cloud is that it federates access. Anybody with a credit card can spin infrastructure up and down. That's the contract we have with the cloud. The flip side of that is you've got to control where those and be able to measure and assess where those costs are coming from. So piece of advice number one, report clearly and report accurately and report consistently. Once you have that clearly understood and you have a very clear view of where those costs are coming from, you have to then make sure that data is shared across the multiple functions that are involved in driving those costs. So it's not enough for finance teams alone to have this data and to have it feeding into their accounting system, right? It's the teams that are driving those costs, whether they're DevOps or just pure sort of software engineering and development or product teams, they have to be looking at the same sets of data as the source of truth, right? And then thirdly, it's a question of accountability, right? In an organization where access to the cloud is federated or distributed across the company, you have to also then distribute the accountability to doing things responsibly. So just to kind of quickly recap, report clearly and accurately, share that data broadly, and then drive accountability to the outcomes and to the changes you want to see.
Thanks a lot, John. Then let me add a fourth advice. Start working with Doit now. Visit link.alphaList.com/cloud to do that. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
That was John Purcell sharing his expertise on optimizing cloud operations. Now let's go to today's episode. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. And today I have a very special guest from Stockholm, Sweden. And we're talking about site reliability engineering. And it's a guy who really knows the topic well, not only because he wrote a book about it called Reliability Engineering Mindset and created a service level calculator. He is working in the industry for years. He worked for many digital native companies. I mostly see Klarna on the digital native companies track. And then worked for also companies that are more traditional.
and now works for Volvo as a senior staff engineer. It's Alex Everlöf. Alex, did I introduce you properly?
Yeah, that was very good. Thank you very much. Everlöf is the last name. How it's pronounced.
Okay, yeah, it's for Germans, kind of, you read Everlöf. Okay. So can you maybe tell us a bit more why you're doing what you're doing? Like, what is your personal nerd journey? When did you start with computing and why?
Yeah, so I started in 1999 and my first job was to assemble computers. You know, we started with family and friends, and then it has scaled. So we go to a shop and we buy components, and then I assemble it and sell it, make a little money. And then after that, I was working as a network administrator. So, you know, with the cables and everything. I did when I was studying my bachelor degree, which was in hardware engineering. And quickly after, you know, I learned enough of programming to actually make money from that, I wrote a small assembly program. And my first programming job was a little bit in the gray area. So I would actually get paid to write assignments for university students who were rich enough to pay me, but lazy enough not to write it themselves. So, and I worked with assembly and C, which was a little bit hard to get wrap your head around. And then after that, I was working with robots that play football. We actually went to Germany, Bremen, in 2006, which was the RoboCup League. And then after that, I pursued my master's degree in interactive systems engineering, which we will talk about. So systems engineering is something I'm very passionate and interested to. And I spent 7 years front-end development, and then with Node.js, which uses JavaScript, I got my feet into back-end development. And then little by little, by accident, actually, I became an SRE. So I was working at a company that, due to financial problems, they decided to get rid of all the QA and DevOps, and they just wanted generic, quote-unquote, generic software developers. So overnight, they gave us admin account on the company's AWS account, and we made some expensive mistakes. We went to courses, and we grew into the role. I didn't know that SRE was a thing. But now, having read Google's books and, you know, working as a SRE in the past 5 years, I really like the single liner from the guy who coined the term. A SRE is what you get when you put software engineers in charge of operation, because they use software practices, you know, automation. And, you know, we software developers, we are very lazy. We want to automate things instead of doing things manually and all that stuff.
Absolutely.
So that's the juice of a SRE.
Absolutely. So you basically spit out many different juicy terms that maybe we can briefly touch on the history of SRE and SRE versus DevOps and SRE versus DevOps versus platform engineering. Mm-hmm. What is the correct path from your perspective? Also looking at larger companies that typically start off with like a central DevOps department and then end up with something totally different because it in many cases doesn't work out. Like, what is your perspective on that? And how does it work at Volvo?
Yeah, so first I talk about like what I have seen in the wild, and then we can talk about how we are doing it at Volvo. So I've, in the past 5 years, I've worked at three companies and I have seen different models. I have an article called Washing Machine versus Laundry Room, which maybe many people in Europe can relate to. So many condominiums, they have the laundry room where you can just go and wash your clothes. But then many people don't do that. They go and buy their own washing machine. Why do they do that? Because of the freedom. When you think about it, it costs more to have your own washing machine, pay for the electricity. If it breaks, it's your responsibility. That's exactly what many of these quote-unquote shadow ITs do. Because they realize that using the central platform team is just too expensive. It's just too unflexible. There is this thing that you want to change and you approach them and they put you through this ticketing system and you have to wait forever. You're treated like yet another customer. Whereas where you build your own platform, it's fit to your product. You have full control over that. Of course, it's going to cost more. And when you're a large organization, you have many of these that you may think that, oh, they are competing with each other. So I've seen this throughout my career many times where people come and try to standardize this, unify all the platforms. And I believe that this is a case of premature optimization. Just like when you're coding and you just may end up optimizing the wrong thing. Without data, it's very hard to optimize. So you have to know what are your bottlenecks and then what's the trade-off between optimizing it, because usually you may make the code more complex and a little bit harder to read. So that's premature optimization. I think premature standardization is the thing that I've been observing several times through my career, where someone comes in and they want to optimize standardize everything. And that's very beautiful, because you want one platform, solve the problem once and then scale it. On paper, in theory, that sounds very good. But in practice, there's a beauty of pluralism, where you have all those different platforms fit to the problem that they are solving. They scale better for the problem that they are solving. But of course, it's going to cost more. So it's not a clear-cut answer. And that's my experience with DevOps. The second part of the question was about the relation between DevOps and SRE and platform engineering. And here, I like to say that Google really knows how to make things popular. They give away stuff for free. A few years ago, where they wanted to grow their...
And complex, right?
And complex. Yeah, exactly. Kubernetes. A few years ago, where they wanted to grow their cloud business, they gave away, of course, Kubernetes, but also they published three excellent books. I love those books, the SRE books from Google that you can reach out from sre.google/books. These books paint a picture of how to cook a Michelin star meal. So many companies, especially the ones who cargo cult anything that comes from big tech, they started doing that. Okay, we want SRE, and they started hiring. But as soon as they started to look into their kitchen, they saw that they don't have all the ingredients, they don't have a fridge, and maybe there is three fires burning, the different platforms. So they started building a kitchen instead. So you wanted to make a food, now you're building a kitchen. And that's where platform engineering comes in. So SRE had a moment 2-3 years ago. It was on the rise, but ever since, platform engineering has taken over, because that's where the industry is. Most companies first need to build a platform, to reach to a level where they can actually implement SRE. Google didn't have these problems. They have the unified platform since they start. So for them, it was a different problem. But I still think that SRE, applying software engineering principles for operational work is very valuable.
And you're working in the car industry. Mm. I have a company that actually buys SaaS companies and operates them. So like we have 18 different companies. We call them brands. Mm-hmm. In the pre-discussion, we found out that our problems are maybe like similar, because we have a lot of different tech in different areas, and we actually buy you buy like external components from different vendors, right? Mm. And we buy companies, and you try to also unify that in a way. And in many cases, you fail, I guess, if you try it too hard. What is your perspective on generalization, standardization there, and how could a common platform look like? Is there a common platform from your perspective, or how does that look like?
There have been many efforts to build a common platform, because it's just the solution itself is just too sexy to ignore. Like, there's just so much value in building a platform that solves everything. But the downside of that is that a platform that fits to a diverse range of problems that you have in a large enterprise is going to be very complex, because it needs to have configuration, needs to fit to all different ways that different teams want to use that platform. And regarding car company, you're absolutely right. We have generally, and this is not just a Volvo. I think many car companies treat software like a car part, which means that...
Especially the German companies, yes. I'm always shocked when I enter a German car and see how the software works. It really isn't beautiful.
Yeah, it was in the news a couple of years ago that one of the big German car companies had some software issues, and it was like all the way to the CEO basically got fired. So it's, yeah, I can relate with that. The reason is that we specify the software requirements. We design the software kind of like how you design a headlamp, and then give it to a third party to give it to you for a fixed price at a fixed deadline. That is how Volvo also operated many, many years ago. But since about 5-6 years ago, there was a strategic decision that at least half the software needs to be built in-house. So what does half software mean? Is like half of the lines of code or half of the components? Like, how do you even count that? That's a high level ambition. In practice, it's very hard to say what is half of the software is built in-house. So Volvo is based in Gothenburg, and Gothenburg has a history in manufacturing. There are many companies based in Gothenburg. That's a very different atmosphere in Stockholm. So the closest manufacturing companies we have here is Scania, which is 35 kilometers away. On the other hand, Stockholm has... So if the west coast of Sweden has mastered the factory belts, the east coast is all about software. So you have Klarna, Spotify, King, Minecraft. Many big tech companies have offices here, AWS, Google, Microsoft, IBM. Volvo made a strategic decision to open office in Stockholm to tap into this talent market and bring software developers into the car company. And here we are. So I joined about 2 years ago, and some of the things have been excellent learning. I have a lot of respect for the brand. I was a Volvo owner before. But I also cannot close my eyes to how different is software from car. So car is usually developed in waterfall. You know, you design it, you test it, and then it goes to manufacturing because it's very expensive. And it has different ownership model, unlike software. So when you give the key to the consumer, they drive off, then it is their car, basically. If something breaks, they have to come to the workshop and they have to pay, or if it is guaranteed, it's going to be free. But software, it doesn't even leave the door. You run it, basically. And if there is defects, you have alerting, you immediately know about it. If one car fails, not all the cars in the world fail, but for software, it's a very different risk model. If there's failure, yeah, that can propagate.
Yeah. But still, isn't there, like these days, a common platform? Like if you look at my SaaS tools, mm-hmm, and if you look at cars, like isn't there, like, I don't know, can't you just use Android in the cars and Linux as a common system, and that's okay? And you can force your manufacturers to use that all, or like how is that, or is it then rather even more abstract and you need Docker as like a standard, or is there no standard?
Yeah. So the question is if we can have a central platform for car software, right? And so car software is very broad. Now I'm inside it, I can see there is software that runs in the infotainment. That's a different platform. And then there is software that runs in, you know, that controls your engine, your brakes, that they are isolated from each other. They use completely different technologies also. And then there is software that where I'm part of the organization that sells cars. So the volvocars.com, that is many of my teams are behind that site. And then there is the site that you can go and book a workshop, you know, the software that runs in the workshop is Windows application, for example. So it's very diverse. It's hard to have one platform that runs all of them.
Well, okay. Yeah. That's obviously also, there's a lot of marketing involved and marketing sites, etc. But just if you look at the core, what runs in the car, then yes, you still have, I don't know, software that is written in assembly that controls your lighting, I guess. Mm. But if you really look at the user experience, then at least you could unify that platform, right? Which is mostly infotainment, as you mentioned.
Yes.
And that's what you do, I guess.
And the mobile app. Like, at least on the surface, they are unified. So they use the same color, the same branding, of course. But behind the scene, they can be different because they're built by different people at different parts of the organization. I think one other car industry, Mercedes, they have a CTO, but they also have a CSO, Chief Software Officer. If I understand correctly, he at least at some point he was in Gothenburg, which is the hometown of Volvo. Yeah, and he has a Swedish name, so I don't know too much. But the part that I like is that they give software, they present software as a first class product in the C-level. And the results show, like, they were one of the few first automotive companies that adopted GitHub Copilot and AI, and they have Mercedes-Benz operating system. So I think that is what many car companies are missing, to have a first-class software person in the C-suite to kind of be the focal point of unifying all the softwares. Without that, it would be very hard to unify.
The face of the software, yeah, and a spokesman, right?
True.
Or a spokeswoman. I agree. But that means that you end up building, if you think about platforms, then you end up building many platforms in many different teams, right?
Yes.
Is your job then looking at it, like zooming out and looking at all of the platforms at once and then operating them, or?
Yeah, so I see platform as part of the application. Sure, it would be awesome if we, like Google or Facebook, we would solve the problem once and then scale it to all different types of problems, but that's not where we are. So they started from the unified platform. They are not heavily invested in that. But one of the value propositions of a standardization is that you pay the price once, right? But if you're in an environment where it is fragmented platforms, you have already paid the cost of those platforms. So why not take advantage of the situation and make sure that at least now that you have a bunch of platforms, they all fit to the purpose, to the application that is built on top of that. And they're part of the same organization. So they cannot just use a veto card and say, oh, but we are a central platform. We are not going to care about your little application. Although the application is the one that is actually making money. Not many companies who build a platform, they're actually making money from the platform. Platform is not the product. Some of them are, but most companies are building a platform to solve a problem. So when the platform is part of the application organization, they follow the same strategy. They are under the same leadership, so they have to align with the applications that are using them.
Okay, understood. If you think about your observer role, you quickly touch topics like having SLAs versus SLOs and SLIs. Can you maybe quickly explain the difference?
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on that, because service levels have been basically my life in the past year. I'm tasked to onboard a relatively large organization, more than 100 teams, into implementing service levels. So the definition. SLI, or service level indicator, these are metrics that measure reliability of your systems. It can be availability, latency, error rate, it can be many things, but these are metrics that define how users see perceive reliability of a system. That's the SLI. And then you have SLO, which is the target that you want to achieve. So that O stands for objective. Service level objective is how reliable you want the system to be. And a key point there is that no system can be 100% reliable. So instead of assuming that system should never fail, and then when it fails, there is panic in the room, there is incidents, finger pointing. Instead of that, you shift the conversation to defining what is failure, which is the definition of service level indicator, because you want to identify the failure. Mm-hmm. And then how much failure can you tolerate? That's the error budget, which is the reverse of service level objective. SLA is an entirely different beast. So SLA has a SLO. SLA stands for service level agreement. These are legal agreements that a company who is selling a service will offer. You mentioned that you have a lot of SaaS companies, so they may have a lot of SLAs. And in the SLA, you have a SLO, which says that, okay, we promise to give you 99% availability. And if we fail to deliver on that promise, then we're going to put money on the table or credit or, you know. So if, and there is a confusion. Sometimes I hear that people confuse SLA and SLO, which is funny because SLA is much more serious. So no two teams have a SLA toward each other unless one team is literally paying the salary of another team, which is very odd. Right, so SLA is a legal agreement. One team is not going to take another team to court. So most often we are just talking about SLO. SLA is very rare. In case of SaaS companies, I understand. But most often it's the SLO that we are after.
And why would you actually use service levels? Is it just a natural progression that you went through, and then at a certain point you just discovered, hey, I just need one service level indicator per team, or two or three, and then I need to have an SLO in place because that's a good agreement? Or like, what is your explanation for
that? Yeah, it's an excellent question. So there is different ways to talk about reliability. This is Google's version. In their SRE books, they talk about service levels, but not every big tech is using that. Not every company is using that. Some of the core ideas behind service levels is that you define a metric at the borders, at the boundaries of the team, about how the system reliability is perceived. And then what goes inside that team, inside the architecture or programming language, is no one's business, basically. Mm-hmm. So you're giving autonomy to the team, but in an aligned and controlled way. So you define the key metrics that identify the health of the services that this team owns. And then you give them the freedom. You say whatever it takes to meet those targets, the service level objectives. So service levels is a good tool in high autonomy environments where either due to the size or lack of mandate, it's impossible to control, you know, the entire architecture. So instead of trying to wrap your head around a very complex system, you just define the service levels that are expected from different systems, and then give the freedom to the teams to meet those objectives.
Mm-hmm. And would you typically combine that with engineering metrics to kind of measure the productivity, or outcome metrics, like, I don't know, tracking the revenue of the team? Or how would you make sure that you have the indicators, you maybe have objectives on those, but you don't want the team to like just operate the platform. You also want the team to work on the future of the platform.
Right. So
how would you make sure that this works?
Not every metric is a SLI, but SLI is a metric. So you have product metrics like, for example, monthly active users or conversion rate. These are measuring how effective is the technical solution to solve a product problem. Then, as you mentioned, you have engineering metrics. Service levels, SLI, SLO, they are primarily concerned with how system reliability is perceived from the consumer point of view. So if there's two teams and one of them is building API for the other one, then you're measuring like how reliability of this particular API is measured. So it's about the systems, whereas engineering metric might be concerned with the engineers, and the product metrics are concerned with the actual product.
So you would combine all those.
You would combine, exactly. They cannot replace each other.
Yeah. And from my perspective, just looking at it, zooming out a bit a little, it absolutely makes sense to look at it. You're kind of looking at things from a user's perspective in most cases, right? And that is a good, that explains, that doesn't need a why, right? Mm-hmm. You don't need to tell people, hey, you have to do this. You all have to jump on that platform and you have to implement it. You have to re-platform. But you're just telling people, hey, we want your users to be happy.
Exactly.
And that is a very good idea. Also, if you look at autonomy, right? And how would you roll it out? Like, if I have my big portfolio of SaaS companies, as an example, how would you roll it out? Like, how would you see service levels entering the room?
Yes. Excellent question. And please stop me if I talk too much, because this basically has been my past 12 months. If you were to ask this question a year ago, I would probably wing it. I wouldn't know. But I've made a lot of mistakes. I got a lot of feedback by rolling it out across a relatively large organization, 100 teams. And currently we have a package that has an intro to service levels. So we use a four-step model to adopt service levels across the organization. Step one is that you understand what is SLI and SLO. So your audience who listens to this podcast, hopefully they gather that much. So I have meeting or presentation that I meet every individual team, and then we basically try to build a language how to speak about reliability with SLI and SLO. That's level one. And then after that, we have a workshop it has several parts. It's a two-hour workshop where we first start talking about what is your service. Okay, you know what is a service level. What is your service? Why does the company pay you? What problem are you solving? So that's going to be the definition of service. And then who is the service consumer? So the service consumer is not the customer, the end not necessarily, you know, it might be a user-facing service, but more often we are meeting a team that has a consumer, which is another team, or maybe a bunch of teams are using their consumer. So identifying them. And we try to have one member of the consumer group in the room, in the workshop. So while we are designing SLI for one team, we bring their consumer into the room, because the point of service levels is to see how the consumers perceive reliability of your service. So they have a say in that. And then after that, we go into the risk analysis mode. So we say, okay, well, what are the things that can fail? And we try to distinguish between root cause and symptom. So root cause is the thing that goes wrong, but symptom is how the consumers would know about what went wrong. And then after that, it's much more engineering friendly. So we try to come up with metrics that allow us to identify failure from the symptoms. For example, the site is down. The site is down is a symptom. The root cause can be that certificate is out of date. Maybe your cloud provider is down. Maybe there is some code broken. It can be many root causes, but the symptom is site is down. So we find a metric to measure the symptom, because we want to tie alerting to the symptom. The hypothesis is that if something breaks, but the user doesn't care about it, it doesn't matter. You don't have to go and wake someone up, you know, on call to go and fix that, because the user didn't notice. So it's very important to find the right SLIs and then tie alerting to that. And the last part of it, actually, it was a little bit tedious. You had to bring your own little calculator. Some people use their phone and some use a computer. And so I made an app that is called Service Level Calculator for the workshops. And it has some examples, which is the most common SLIs that I have seen in the wild. And then it has knobs and buttons where you can control it and see how in action your SLI would look like. And that brings the team to the level two, where you start measuring it. So you implement your observability tooling. It can be Datadog, Grafana, Elastic, what have you. And then you tie that to alerting, which brings the team to the most mature level, which is the level four. So step four, sorry. So step four teams not only have identified the needle, you know, how reliability is measured, and not only they have tied it to observability, which means that their needle is moving, and they have a written contract with their consumer about how reliability is perceived and what is their SLO, the objective, but they also are confident enough to be on call for those metrics. That's the most mature in this four-level model that we have defined. And just to wrap up on like how to roll it out across the organization, it's very important not to demand. So one of the first things that I said before I take this assignment is that I'm not going to chase teams to implement service levels. But I would be like a flea market salesman at the corner, you know, shouting SLI, everyone SLI. And then I rely on opt-in and word of mouth. Because if the teams actually want to operate this way, then I can support them. And we have a Slack channel. We have loads of documentation. Like I mentioned, I'm also writing a book about all the things that I've learned rolling this out across large organization. That's a very different take than mandate heavy, where someone comes to the room and say, from tomorrow, everyone has to do service level. Because then you get a lot of vanity metrics where people are measuring, you know, CPU usage, memory usage, something that no one cares about, without actually talking to their consumer. And they're not, their heart is not going to be with that, because they didn't understand the why. Whereas in our initiative, rolling it out across large organization, we have spent a lot of time answering why. Why are we doing this? Actually, today I have a meeting for my colleagues in Polestar to answer that question. Why service levels is the right way to think about aligning autonomy?
But isn't there, like, per definition, a common ground also for your industry, where you can say, like, if I look at it, I say, hey, all of my SaaS companies has a marketing site, like a website and an application. So I can do at least uptime monitoring. And it's like crystal clear. Hey, when your app is down or your marketing site is down, you have to do something. So it's an indicator that could be there per default, right? Is that too much enforcement from your perspective?
No, that's very good. Actually, many companies... So availability is the most common SLI. You know, it's also called uptime. But then how you measure it, there's four different ways to measure it, which I don't get into that. It's table, and it's very hard to say that in a podcast audio format. But basically, you can do the absolute minimum, which is ping the endpoint every minute. Is it up? Is it up? Is it up? And combine this information into a table. Or you can do the most mature way, which is that you have real user monitoring, which actually monitors the actions of the users. And if they fail, for example, the sales flow is broken. Sales flow might have many, many steps through the products of several teams. But if any step is broken, then you declare that, okay, the site is not available. So depends on how you define the availability metric. It can give different signals. But availability is not the only one. There is latency also. There is throughput. You know, for LLMs, for example, you want to see I'm paying for a very expensive, beefy NVIDIA machine. So am I getting the performance out of this machine that I'm paying? Like, is it really worth it? So you may monitor the token per second, for example, that you're getting out of that machine. Mm. But availability is a very good first start. Like, that's the absolute minimum that we need to think about when we think about service levels.
And the rest can actually live in the teams, right?
Exactly.
And then it's more like having a lighthouse score per team or like a dashboard that basically combines all of their indicators. And what if let's say you're tracking uptime and a service fails? Like, what happens? Like, how does on-call work? Is there someone centrally picking up the phone, or does it necessarily have to be the team that actually caused the downtime? Like, who's picking up the phone?
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked this, because this is the area I've been thinking a lot about. So in my world, before joining my current company, it's the team who is responsible, because the idea is that you build it, you own it. If it's your system, it breaks, you're the one who has to pay for it, wake up in the middle of the night. But also, you're the best person to fix the problem, because you have built it. You know exactly all the moving parts. Whereas many companies, especially enterprise companies, they have a central operation team that is going to be the first responder. There's value for that also, because many of the issues might actually be no-brainer to fix that. You may need to restart a service or empty a cache or something of that nature, and they can do some of that. And another thing that the central incident handling operation team can do is to verify the incident. You know, if someone reports that the site is broken, okay, they verify it. Okay, it is actually broken. It's not your internet that is broken. It's our site. It's our fault. And then triage it, which means that they can assess a priority. Is the P1 priority one, or is it P2? You know, does it worth to actually wake up an engineer? So there is good and bad. Depends on how we want to do that. Larger organizations usually can afford to have a central team. But the problem, or the anti-pattern, is that this central team will be the default go-to for all the incidents. Because... Mm. That is not good, because it's going to increase your MTTI, or mean time to identify, or mean time to detect an incident. Whereas if the team is responsible, they are going to be the first responders, and they're going to be the ones who can resolve the incidents as soon as possible. So I'm more inclined to say that the team should be the default. But if something falls between the cracks, you know, in a complex organization, you have many teams, things can fall between the cracks. It's good to have a central team who can help with that. Plus, for some major incidents, you may actually need what is called MIM, or major incident managers, who are responsible for coordinating communication with the CEO and with the external stakeholders and with legal, you know, for example, a GDPR incident. So for those kind of huge incidents, you cannot expect everyone in every team to know everything there is for those kind of cases. So there is value in having a central team, but not the default.
And also for like, let's say, I don't know, Fastly is down or Cloudflare is down for those incidents where, if they happen in the middle of the night, you don't have to wake up anyone, right?
That's true.
Or at least it would be okay if just one person wakes up and says, hey, we're down. It's okay. We have to accept it. Fastly is resolving it, or Cloudflare. And for that, it kind of makes sense. And maybe you can also have like a little less... not say professionalism in the individual teams, but you don't have to at least implement on-call necessarily fully, right? That's how I see it. Like, you can see it a bit more relaxed. You can rely on the central team that then, I don't know, calls the leader in the individual organization or in the individual team whenever it's really, really needed, right? And otherwise, you don't need to necessarily implement on-call fully. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Like on call during the night is heavily regulated, at least in Sweden. I think Germany is the same, where the unions have a big say. So the companies cannot force people to wake up in the middle of the night. Actually, my previous company, which is American, we had hubs in London, Stockholm, and in New York. And I was implementing this model of on-call. And I learned that, at least in that company, the American colleagues didn't get any money if they are on-call, which was a surprise. Because in Sweden, you get on-call compensation whether the incident happens or not. Some companies do it differently. If the incident happens, then they pay you. But, you know, no pay, that's a bit weird. But the argument for the American company was that you're already getting paid a salary. So why should we pay you to wake up in the middle of the night? It's your thing that is broken, so go and fix it. Bit different attitude.
Well, it's a valid argumentation. Well, but if Cloudflare or Fastly is down, it doesn't count anymore,
no,
right?
No, exactly. Yeah, and also one of the reasons for being an employee is that you get your fixed salary every month, and then you kind of offload that risk. If you were going to take this kind of risk, then you would go and make your own startup. Like, that's a little bit unfair without payment.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So let's say Uptime is my SLI. I found it, like, or how do I find it, actually? I mean, for my example, it's very natural, but how do I find the perfect SLI for my team?
So in the workshop, like I mentioned, we go through, first identify the services and consumers, have the consumer in the room, and then let the consumer say how they perceive it. And of course, if you just ask them, how do you perceive our reliability, they're not going to be able to answer that. So in order to have a meaningful conversation, we go into risk analysis and we try to identify root cause and symptom. And there the consumer starts talking. I actually had a very interesting encounter. One of the workshops we had, the consumer, and you know, the engineers went into the risk analysis mode and they say, oh, the API is down, API is slow, you know, those are the risks. And the consumer said, you know, actually, yeah, these things that you say, they're valid. But from our perspective, many incidents happen where you're rendering a page and you have mixed different languages in that. So I'm based in Sweden. I'm asking a page in Swedish, but then you have put some English or German in it. So that is the incident from our perspective, because I will not be able to use your application. And it's actually very common that once you put the consumer in the driving seat, they talk about incidents that is very hard to measure. But that's exactly the point. That's why we are doing service levels with the consumer in the room. Because without the consumer, it's far too common. I'm actually guilty of that also, to measure the wrong thing. You measure CPU usage and you assume that if your CPU usage goes up, then it's something is broken. Whereas when you are asking the consumer, you may find metrics that are very hard to measure. In some cases, you may actually have to write an external service just to measure the right thing. But then you have quality data and you feel confident to tie your on-call into that. Because that's how consumers perceive reliability. Instead of having vanity metrics, which may lead to alert fatigue. Alert fatigue is when your alert is too trigger happy and just wake you up.
Yeah. The always red light.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Too much on call.
Yeah. And coming to SLOs, what does actually make sense there? I mean, we all know the good old 99.99999% uptime. What is a fair SLO?
So very interesting question, because naively, I actually have a meme about this where our CTO wanted 5 9s and we had resources for 2. There is a rule of thumb that for every 9 you add to your SLO, so if it is 99 and you say, I want 99.9, you're adding a little 9 there. Your reliability is going to increase by a factor of 10, but also your cost is often increased by a factor of 10 as well, because you may actually have to refactor, you have to re-architecture. Maybe you have to change your vendor. Maybe you were running on a cloud provider that's not very reliable, but you need a more reliable partner. And all of this add to the cost. So there is a point of diminishing return that we need to be very careful when we are defining SLO. So one of the biggest difference between SLO and OKR, both of them got popularized by Google. OKR actually doesn't come from Google, but they got really popularized, is that the O in both of them stands for objective. In OKR, you try to aim high and then you celebrate if you land below that. right? It's ambitious. Whereas for SLO, I really like this quote from a Google PM. It said, SLO is the worst number that you can get away with. So you try to under-promise and over-deliver. It's a completely different mm-hmm. beast. And the reason for that is because the higher the SLO, the higher the cost that the team has to pay in terms of engineering. Maybe you even need more people. So you have to think about that also. These nines are not free. That's the point I'm trying to make. So it depends on the type of the business. You may actually have different SLIs. And there is no rule that says that, by the way, that it has to be comprised of nines. For one of the products I'm working with, it's 98.3, right? So we have to do the math to see what is the error budget? How much can I fail and still the business will run? So it's about business continuity, how much money you're making, because you have to trade off between the cost of building those systems versus the money that you're making from those systems. So if it's an open source project like my service level calculator that I'm not making any money from, that is completely free, I don't care about the reliability of that. Of course, I want this to be as reliable as possible, but I'm not going to be on call for that and pay for that. So that equation needs to be part of the conversation when deciding SLO. If you don't, then you have that meme that I was talking about. So five nines is the realm of your airport control tower or your hospital systems. These systems can fail like 2.6 seconds per month. Can a media site fail more than that? Absolutely. Actually, we did some UX study and we realized that that company that I'm talking about, it was a media company, that we can fail 2 hours per month comfortably. And the users, if we fail more than that, then the users may consider going to a competitor. But 2 hours is safe. So that was our error budget and we defined our SLO based on that.
And does it make sense to have a financial incentive when, to fail less, or is that weird?
Don't go there. Yeah, actually, I in that company, one of the ideas from engineering managers was that maybe we should tie the SLO to the bonus program to kind of motivate people. But that's actually, when you mix these engineering metrics, it can also be the product metric, engineering metrics, or reliability metrics. When you tie a metric to a financial incentive, then there's a very strong motivation to game the metric. Now, there are metrics that if you want to game it, you actually end up with a better situation. Like, for example, I didn't mention this, but I was on call a few years ago, and we would get paid regardless if an incident happens or not. And that was a company that actually fired all the QA and DevOps. And we software engineers, we are lazy. We want to game the system, right? So we tested the hell out of this system. By the time I was leaving, we had 3,500 unit tests, integration tests, smoke tests, you name it, we had it. And the system was super reliable because we didn't want to wake up in the middle of the night. So the company ended up with a better, more reliable system. And we software engineers, we got easy money because we would get paid. So it is possible, but it's very tricky to tie these metrics to some sort of financial incentive. You might be familiar with the Cobra effect, where the Brits were in India. They actually paid for every Cobra head. So people started farming Cobras. But then after a while, the Brits decided not to pay for that, and people released all these Cobras in the nature, and then the problem became even worse than when they started. So it's very, very hard to tie something to some financial incentive to the metric. I would say that start a small experiment with a very small team if you really want to go that way and see how it pans out, and then scale it instead of saying that from tomorrow every team's SLO is connected to their bonus, because then people are going to game it and you don't know what will happen after that. Or maybe they measure the wrong thing, vanity metrics. We are up, boss, 100%. So pay us the bonus. Whereas in reality, the system is failing.
Okay. Very, 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 very helpful discussion, to be honest. I think you create many more adopters of SLIs and SLOs here. Do you have maybe 2 to 3 tips on the common pitfalls and what to avoid in that field
For service levels?
Yes.
Yeah, measuring the wrong thing, that's the most common issue I see. So one of the reasons we are doing the intro and workshop and meeting every team is to find what metric makes sense to every particular product, and we bring the consumer into the room. These are all I think it is written somewhere between the lines in the Google's books, but I haven't seen that in the wild. And I'm certainly guilty of measuring the wrong thing myself as well. And the other one is, as you mentioned, tying some financial incentive to the to those metrics. That's a very risky business, so you have to really know what you're doing. My advice is to start small. And then the last one, which is very close to my heart, is to have sort of like a big dashboard, the company level, with very good visibility for all the service levels, and then use that to benchmark teams against each other, or you know, playing the blame game. Because the moment people embarrass to you know, show their data, then they're gonna show the wrong data or game the system or the metric is gonna lag. So it's demotivating. And the reason I say it's close to my heart is because I was working at one company, and every week we had a meeting with the CTO where we would go through the incident data, and there was a lot of screaming and shouting, and it wasn't a very good culture. So I would say that if your culture cannot handle openness of exposing the metrics, then don't do that. Let the teams to be responsible for their service levels, and just tie the team on-call rotation to the service levels and call it a day if you cannot really expose it. But ideally, you want a transparent culture where everyone can see everyone's service levels. For example, if you're using...
Maybe at least the broadest, right? Like, I don't know, uptime. Like,
yeah.
Let's show it to everyone. Like, hey, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? Why is it down for a day? Why has it been down for a day? What were your learnings, etc.?
Exactly.
I think that yes, it's a bit competitive, but on the other end, if you just focus on the broad things, then it will lead to like organizational learning, which is I guess the end goal, right? Mm.
So service levels are for system reliability. So it's the system that is failing. It's not people's fault per se. Yeah. So that's the blame part is the part that I'm trying to highlight here. If you're measuring the right thing, and you know, you're not tying it to financial incentive, but it's very important to keep the conversations on what caused this failure and what failed. It's about the systems. It's not about the people. So that people will kind of grow into their roles and improve their reliability. It's a bit tricky, especially when it comes from high level leadership, where they have a lot of mandate, they have a lot of respect in the organization. If they blame the teams, that is a very good way to make sure that service levels is not going to work in your organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, thanks a lot for all the insights. Very 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 helpful. I still have like a little surprise for you, like my little outro question. Yeah. I recently tested the new Volvo EX30, so the new Volvo electric car. And it actually, in the infotainment system, had like a hidden menu, which I think one of your teams built, which actually allows you to travel in time. I actually, using that Volvo car, right? Like the good old McLaren. And I actually used the Volvo to travel back into your life in the year 2009 when you worked as scientific researcher at Philips. Mm-hmm. And we now observe yourself like doing lots of research back then. Young Alex, still very curious. And young, like what would you whisper into young Alex's ears?
Yeah, I
think if you had the chance.
I have two things I would like to say to the younger version of myself. One is to stay curious, because I have been discouraged from, you know, going outside my role definition, or, you know, I've been called restless. At some time, I was called the rough diamond, which is a Swedish code for someone who is valuable, but it's very rough. You haven't really cut it. So I would say, stay curious and stay true to yourself. It eventually pays off. So you might be in the wrong environment, but you will eventually find environments where you can actually flourish. That's one thing. The other one, which is a recent, like in the past few years since I was promoted to leadership, I see that we humans are hardwired to confuse confidence with competence. We often assume that if someone is talking very confidently, they must be confident. Whereas in reality, they must be competent. When in reality, that might not always be the case. Like if someone is really competent, they may be confident. That's not always the case either. But too often I see that someone is confidently saying stuff, you know, making up stuff, or they know just so little. I think ignorance is a bliss. Like when you don't know so much, you are much more confident. The Dunning-Kruger effect. So that is something that I think that confused me a lot in the past 10 years. There was a lot of people that I looked up to, and I tried to learn from their, how they do the stuff, and I got advice from them. But then later I realized it was wrong advice, so they really didn't know what they're talking about. So that is something I try to be aware of these days. And I certainly try not to be that person. I don't know. It's up to your audience how confidently I talked about this stuff that I have worked with. But yes, that's a risk. That's the warning.
Thanks a lot. Any shout out on like follow up, like if people wanna talk to you, wanna chat to you, or wanna consume your stuff, like where can they find out more?
Yeah, so I have a website. From there you can find everything about me. I have a newsletter, I have my books there. And also I will maybe this year be more active on YouTube, but all of this stuff you can find just by searching my name, which is a little bit hard to pronounce probably. So I hope that you can put it in the description. AlexJewelof.com is the name. And I'm very active on LinkedIn. So I write about technical leadership. I'm a senior staff engineer, so I write about that, which is something close to my heart. And site reliability. I care about these two topics, plus growth. So I mentioned that my master is in systems engineering. I am a big advocate of using systems thinking in one's life and career growth. So these are the three topics I cover.
So thanks a lot. We put the URL in the show notes as well.
Thank you
to make
very
it
much.
A little easier with the ooh. was great to talk to you. And hope to meet you soon.
Thanks for having me, Tobias.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alpha List podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. Alpha List is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphalist.com. Send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on AlphaList, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.